Welcome to the Bob McCallum Podcast, a repeat performance, as we are taking a little sabbatical here over the holidays, and we'll be back next Monday for another live program. Broadcasters, not too hard to get them. We know most of them, but here's a couple of interesting ones.
Yeah.
Cuthbert and Hewson, the most recent and current play-by-play voices of Hockey Night in Canada, and Swirsky and Devlin, the former and current voices of Raptors basketball on television. And I assume, if I recall correctly, they will compare stories.
But it's interesting how all four of them, you can certainly get a sense of their styles of play-by-play in the way they tell their stories too, Bob. It's a fascinating listen to the derivation of how a guy calls a game and what he gets out of a game and what he needs to do for the viewers.
Cuthbert and Hewson, Swirsky and Devlin, this time on the Bob McCallum Podcast. And off we go. It's McCallum, it's Shannon with you on this Friday as we bring the week to a close. And what better way to do it when the two most prominent hockey play-by-play guys in the country. Jim Hewson and Chris Cuthbert, both with us simultaneously. And I can't, I have to take the opportunity to, with both of you on here. My first question is maybe an obvious one, but everybody that gets into this business grows up having listened to somebody else and maybe not patterning yourself after them, but that was kind of the reason why you went down the road you went down. It's different for me, not a play-by-play guy, but I'm very intrigued by who your influences were especially before you got into the business. Chris, I'll give it to you first.
Well, good to be with you guys. Good to be in the same room with Jim, because that rarely happens for play-by-play guys. We're always somewhere else in opposite rinks, but nice to be with you. For me, it was going to bed every night with a transistor radio under my pillow and listening to Dan Kelly at KMOX or Foster Hewitt on CKFH or whoever was calling that game. And often on a Sunday night, it might even be Bob Cole on CBC Radio with the Sunday night game. And, you know, by osmosis, I think those gentlemen and Danny Gallivan on Saturday night television, by osmosis, you pick things up. You certainly shouldn't be copying any of them, but certainly influenced the way I called games. And I'm going to steal some Jim Hewson thunder, but I think I hear Jim Robson a little bit when I listen to Jim Hewson.
True. Oh,
without a doubt. Without a doubt. Mentor and a great friend. So when I was in high school, I had a part-time job at a local radio station in northern British Columbia. And one of my jobs was in the summer when the BC Lions were playing, or in the winter when the Canucks were playing. This radio station was on the network that carried the Canuck games. So I would sit through the evening, and my job was to plug in the commercials when the network went off to a commercial. So I sat and listened very intently to Jim Robson as he called all the games. And then later I got a chance to work with him. My first job in the NHL was to fill in for Jim on the radio on Saturdays when he worked at Hockey Night in Canada. So that's how I got my opportunity to work in the NHL. And as Chris mentioned, you automatically copy some things if they're good. You know, like I have a book, and we all, as play-by-play guys, usually have a notebook that we lay in front of us. I still lay it out exactly the way Jim Robson did his, because I looked at his and thought, that's perfect. Why would I change that? Why wouldn't I just do that? And then the obvious influences of the people who work the national games. Danny was always an inspiration to me, because I got to know him and he was such a wonderful guy. And the way he called the game. One of the things that I learned from Danny was that there was never a bad game. When he called he could make the worst game come to life. And I always thought, just because it's a bad game, there is a redeeming quality and you got to find it somewhere.
You don't write as small as Robson, though, do you?
No, and not as legibly.
Oh, I tell you, Jimmy had the Jimmy all those years. I'd see the notebook, and there is not a chance I could read a sentence in that notebook or a number in that notebook.
And John, you couldn't read anything in mine either. But the key to writing things down is retention, you know, because you never really look at it. But I still, on the left-hand column of my little notebook, I still put, and this is a Robsonism for sure, what the weather was like in the city I'm in that day. 15 degrees and cloudy. And
what's the relevance?
Nothing.
Nothing.
Absolutely nothing. But he did it all the time, and I started doing it. And then you can become a creature of habit.
Like, sure.
It's got to be there or I'm not prepared.
Buddy, I used to love listening to Danny give the weather. He'd tell you what the weather was like in Montreal on a certain game as well.
Yeah.
Did you guys grow up wanting to be play-by-play guys? Because I mean, it's a part of broadcasting, but it's such a unique part. Or did you just want to be on radio or on television? Which was the case, Chris?
I think I did want to be a play-by-play guy. I'd be in the basement no matter what time of year, baseball, football, hockey, and I guess looking back on it, I realize now I was hanging off every word. And I do remember turning off the audio on the television for some CFL games. I was a big Ottawa Rough Rider fan, and I remember calling plays as a kid, but at the same time thinking, there's no chance this is ever going to happen. Those guys are the luckiest guys in the world. They're special. I'm not. This is not going to happen. And not till university, when really my job options were almost nil, at least I felt like they were, did I have the audacity, I guess, to take the full plunge into it. And I was lucky enough at university that they had a radio station that did play-by-play of university football and hockey at Queens. So I got some practical experience that very few people at that age would get. So I was lucky.
Huey, were you bent on being a play-by-play guy?
No, not at all. I was going to be an actor. I was in the theater department. And then I realized when I went to university how little it paid. But I'd had a part-time job at a radio station. So I go back up to this small radio station in Fort St. John in northern British Columbia. And the sports department consisted of one guy, and he was the director. And
of course.
And as is the case in most of those small radio stations, everybody's looking for a job somewhere else, trying to move up. And he moved. And I was the only guy left in the radio station who knew a puck from a football. And I loved hockey. I mean, I played it every day. I was still, at that point, I was still playing on the local junior team. So I took over and started broadcasting the local senior games and just sort of muddled my way through it. And it looked like, at that point, I thought, geez, this might be the ticket to $50 more a month. And that's exactly why I moved on to Penticton and Kelowna and Brandon, Manitoba, and places like that. And I just kind of fell into it, but certainly got a passion for it. And then when I got a taste of what it's like to do an NHL game, that sort of sealed it for me. That was going to be my vocation no matter what.
The fascination of that is that where Chris grew up in suburban Toronto, in that with that transistor radio, you could pick up 6 or 7 or 8 different NHL games a night.
Yes.
You, Chris or Jim, you got one.
And we had no TV. Like we had one channel on TV, right. And we didn't get all of the Hockey Night in Canada game. But we had what we had, John, in small town northern British Columbia were the Fort St. John Flyers, who were the greatest team I'd ever seen play. They played in the Southeast Hockey League. And if I wasn't at the game watching them or scraping the ice in the intermission when I got old enough, I was listening to the game on the radio at the local hot stove league, and I loved it, and it was local culture. So my love of the game and initially of listening to broadcasts came local, because that's the only option we had. The only other radio station I could get is in the midnight, lying in bed, I could listen to CFUN in Vancouver, and I'd wake up in the morning and it would be gone and squawking.
With Jim Houston and Chris Cuthbert. So I've never really added it up, but I think I've done over 10,000 broadcast shows. I have never once listened to a tape of myself. And
not even the podcast?
Why would I listen to this? You're on it.
See, I just set you up every time. I just give you the line. And
thank you. Would you come out to the golf course next time I play and put the ball on the tee too? I'm having a little trouble bending over at this age.
Well,
so the point of the matter is that I don't think that's normal. I'm told that that's not normal. That most people who are broadcasters do go back and listen to themselves in an effort to understand what they did and make corrections. Are you those guys? Jimmy, I'll give this one to you first.
Yeah, I do that. And not for, not for obvious reasons. You know, I don't want to say, how did my voice sound tonight? No, that's not it. I always ask the question at the end of the night, did we tell the story of the game? Then listen to the coaches and the players and see if what I saw and what we said collectively on a broadcast and how we analyzed it is in jives with what they felt, and just to make sure that the story was told. And the other thing is to, I've found over the years that if you listen back and watch back, you correct some redundancies.
Sure.
You know, pick out little things, the crutch phrases and things like that, that bother the heck out of me. And I like to eliminate. How about you, Chris?
Yeah, that's, you know what? I listen less and less because I'm never comfortable, and I don't know about you guys, but not even comfortable with the sound of the voice. But I do want to eliminate those crutch phrases. And I've found I'm very grateful for the one-hour summary broadcast now, because I don't have to put up with myself as long. But I'll often start maybe 10 minutes and then enough of that, but I do want to pick out not mistakes as much as, yeah, you start getting into a habit of calling the same play the same way all the time. And I once was given an article about improving your writing, and it talked about pulling the weeds out of your scripts to make it read better. And I find it's the same thing. I'm looking for weeds to pull out of my next broadcast.
Getting from point A to B in the fewest number of words and being explanatory. And the other thing when you watch back is that you don't need to watch the whole thing. You can spot watch it because you know exactly after the game which part you want to see and you want to hear, because you know the parts that you don't need to go back and watch the parts and listen to the parts that you thought were okay, because something will come into your mind and say, we messed that up. I got to listen to it.
Yep. And the oldest adage though in broadcasting, and it is a cliche, but it's true, is it's never as good as you thought and never as bad as you thought. And I refuse to watch the 2010 gold medal game because I don't want to hear any mistakes. I have a good feeling about that game, and I just want to keep it that way.
Yeah, good.
John, jump in here.
You know, it's funny because the two people that got mentioned early as the mentors, Jim Robson and Dan Kelly, were two polar opposites for that very reason. Jim would lament over every word, every game. I mean, having worked with both of them a lot, Jim would come out of the booth and I would be higher as a producer. I would be higher than a kite because it was a spectacular game. It was a really good broadcast. And I'd say, great game, Jim. And he said, you know, at the start of the third period, I think I said Gradine rather than, Eldebrink. And I would turn and look at him and say, Jimmy, come on. Nobody noticed, but Jim was so meticulous about his craft. Dan, on the other hand, you'd walk in and you'd say, hey, Dan, great job. Yeah, I know, we were fantastic, weren't we? and these two guys were polar opposites.
Yeah.
Polar opposites of how they viewed their roles, the game. And it's fascinating to see that both of you guys have picked opposite guys to say that those guys are the driving forces.
One of the lines I learned from Jim Robson very early in my career was usually by the first commercial break, his line would be, "There goes the perfect broadcast."
All right. Without being specific, because we don't want to embarrass anybody. Part of the job of a play-by-play guy is to work with a sidekick, a commentator. Have you had guys that were difficult to work with? Have you had I assume you've had situations where the two of you weren't in sync either for a night or for a long period of time. Tell some stories. Names are not necessary.
Well, I've got one that immediately comes to mind, and it's an unusual one because I was the color guy, and John might remember in Washington, Molestar or Canadian Sports Network or whatever it was at the time was asked to help out with the Washington broadcasts. And for a year, they sent Danny Gallivan. But the next year, I think they put it in the hands of George Michael. And I went down to be a color guy. And George Michael basically introduced me to the game in the 15 minutes in the lead up, telling me how bad Danny Gallivan was as a broadcaster. And that was not going to work. And it was an uncomfortable night. I think it was my one and only color game as a Washington Capitals broadcaster. But that didn't go well.
I was actually, that. Go ahead, Jim. Go ahead.
Oh, because I worked with the same guy. I got, and in my time at Canadian Sports Network, I was in that period of time too, where they had this agreement. And his show, George Michael's Sports Machine, was like huge in America. Yeah. And so he was this iconic figure that I didn't really know. Because in those days, I mean, when did I see Sports Machine? Not very often, only if I happened to be in the United States. And so I had a very similar experience, but sitting beside a guy who really didn't want me to be there, and just talked over everything. And it was like, I got a word in every 15 minutes and that was about it. But for the most part in, up here, I've been so lucky with great guys to work with all the time who, it's wonderful when the person you work with every day also becomes your best friend, as I have with Craig Simpson, for example. And never have I worked on broadcasts where all the cabs go with one person in a different direction at the end of the night. Fortunate that we all go together.
We just to finish the Washington story, I was a little involved in that stuff. And David Poyle, who was the manager there at that point, came and said, you know, we really need to improve our television broadcast. Can we do anything? And a group of us came with the idea, well, you know, Danny could paint a picture. Danny would be great. Danny was also winding his career down with our company. I don't think he knew that at the time, but he that was a reality. And so we thought if we put Danny in there, we could Danny reinvent, that style of play-by-play in Washington, for a year, to help the club. And it was an unmitigated disaster because the American hockey fan could not understand what Danny was doing. Now, this was in the '80s. The interesting thing is in many ways, Doc Emmerich.
I was just going to say that, John. Yep.
Doc Emmerich's style, it was so much like Danny's. And I do think that Doc kind of patterned himself after Danny a few times. For a guy in his 70s, Danny was actually ahead of his time in Washington. Yep. Everything you talked about there, the Washington experiment for the year was just, it was a painful, painful night. Now, this was a year where we did a lot of games in Washington, 25. We didn't do every game. It was only one game a week. But it was a painful, painful experience when we tried to do it with Danny and with the Caps.
As a non-play-by-play guy, I'm intrigued by the word style, and it's come up a few times here in this conversation. So I am nothing more than an observer of what you guys do with no background skill set or whatever. But I'm intrigued by the word style. What exactly is a style for a play-by-play guy? Jimmy?
Whatever you fall into, whatever it works. So for a long time, I used to get, and still do actually, get young aspiring play-by-play guys would send me tapes and ask me to, you know, critique this and go over it. And I would meticulously go over it with a fine-tooth comb and give them direction about which style you should use here and what verbiage you should use here. And then as I evolved myself and started, you know, busily working on my own game and doing that, I thought, you know what? I'd listen to everybody who does games in the National Hockey League, and there's no right and there's no wrong. There's the way you find to do it. You know, there's no voice that's better than the other. It's the voice that the fans trust. It's the voice that you grow comfortable with. There are guys who for 30 and 40 years, if we went into the style book, if you will, just break every rule, but are beloved in their communities because they are the voice of their team. And so what's wrong with that? So the style is what you find that works. I find it, you know, when you've got to be cognizant of the game. And for me, I'm working national games all the time, so there's always two teams in the game, which isn't always the case if you're a local broadcaster. And I'm okay with that. So style, it's what you find that works for you.
And it might be our own ear or our own interpretation. I always thought Dan Kelly was technically the best because he just seemed to be, I can't even describe why I thought that, but Danny Gallivan was the artist. He added that extra to it. There's a derogative saying about some play-by-play guys that they're just bingo callers, and it really is a bare bones thing, which, and I don't even think that's wrong. I think sometimes I've worked with a couple producers, and I'm not talking about you, John, but they want to keep you in place by saying, you're just a bingo caller. But I will tell a story from my very first game and I think John was, I think you were in the truck. I actually, my whole goal in my career was to work on Hockey Night in Canada, and my mind has gone completely blank on my first ever call, but it was Quebec and Calgary in 1984. And I got through it. And 2 days later, I got a call from Ralph Mellenby, and it wasn't very complimentary. He did concede at the end that it sounded okay, but Ralph had laid out this new agenda for the young upcoming play-by-play guys that he wanted more conversation. NBC was also big on this, even 20 years later, that they talked a lot about, we want conversation, we don't want a traditional call. And so I think there's been a push probably that started in the 80s and it still continues about that mix between bingo call and conversation. And I'm still working on what the right combination of the two is.
I hate to tell you, Chris, but it was 4-4. It was at the Saddle Dome. Quebec and Calgary. Charlie Bourgeois scored a goal late in the game for Calgary to tie the game, and it was an electric night at the Saddle Dome because the Flames had come back to win. Your point about Ralph was very accurate, but we were also changing the whole concept of what a color man was, and it affected both of what you guys were doing because we were going from, in those days, Dick Irvin as a color man, Brian McFarland was the color man, and whether it was Howie or even Babe Pratt or even Ted Reynolds in Vancouver as a color man, we were going to former players. And so Ralph wanted to bring a lot more of the why to the game. And the only way to bring out the why with the players early on was for the play-by-play guy to ask why. Because the player, it was just not in their mindset to explain stuff. And that's why that happened. But I remember the game. I remember most games, but I remember that game for you, Chris, simply because it was such an exciting night. And I remember you coming out of the booth saying, boy, I'm not sure how good I was, but I had a great game to call. And that's what made that that first night for you exciting.
Just an insight on the, what I do remember is 2 days earlier, the Flames had played and you had brought me in early to watch that game. And I walked by the studio that night and was introduced to the new host of the midweek Calgary Flames games, a guy by the name of Ron McLean. Small world.
I'm always astounded with these conversations of people remembering things from 20, 30, 50 years ago. I can't remember what I did last Tuesday.
We did a podcast, Bob. We just did a podcast. That was it.
That may be the least significant thing that I did, but I can't remember anything else about it.
But when it's, when it's 40 years ago, you can make it up.
Sorry, say again.
That's true.
No.
When it happened 40 years ago, you can make it up, and nobody, who's going to call you on that? Who's going to say it's wrong?
They can find it now. You guys would call me on it if you were there, because you remember. And I have absolutely no recollection of any show I've ever done, really. In a generic sense, sure, but in a specific sense, none whatsoever. I finish, it's over, it's out of my mind. And you guys can point to specific things that happened. I find it astounding.
Bob, I will tell you, I get on Twitter, people will send me links to former broadcasts and on YouTube, and I'll put it on just to see what it was or for 5 minutes. And honestly, there are games that I do not remember I called.
Yeah.
I called one of two, was it Jeff Fry hit for the cycle for the Blue Jays? And it's only happened twice in Blue Jay history. I had no recollection of that. And I should have, I don't know why. Wow. And there's some playoff hockey games. Oh, I was there. So, yeah, I think because you do thousands of games and you're cramming for that night and then you move on to the next game, sometimes the memories aren't as good, but other things just stand out forever.
Go ahead, Huey, quick.
I was just going to say, I thought I remembered vividly my first ever game, National Hockey League broadcast, and it was on the radio. And it was in 1979, and I picked the date and I got a researcher to find the game sheet. And I was looking at it and thought, yep, that's the game, only to have Jim Robson say to me, no, I did that. And then tell me, no, that was in October. Your game, your first game was in December. And here's where it is. I thought I had it nailed, but I was 3 months off.
Oh.
That's a great story. I'm glad I paused there. We have to take a quick break. We'll come right back. Jim Houston, Chris Cuthbert with us this time. Back after these. It's McCowan and Shannon with Houston and Cuthbert, who need no further introduction. We were talking about play-by-play becoming more conversational, which is tougher to do with hockey because it's moving all the time. I mean, do you guys remember Phil Rizzuto on Yankee broadcast?
Oh, yeah.
And how, I mean, you could watch 10 minutes and neither with a play-by-play guy nor Scooter would tell you anything about what's gone on. They'd be telling you stories about going to the grocery store before the game or the kids yesterday or, you know, my new car or whatever. That's much, that you can do that in baseball and especially on television. How much different is it doing radio versus television for the play-by-play guy? I know there's the obvious, but tell us about that, Chris.
Well, I was going to defer to Jim here because I think baseball is unique, and I didn't feel I could ever be a great baseball announcer because I didn't think I was steeped enough in the sport to, and I guess I would have immersed myself, but Jim did, and he did an outstanding job at it. You know, hockey doesn't give you time to be too much of a storyteller on TV. I would think it would give you much less on radio. And I've done very little radio play-by-play except at the tier two junior level. And that was when I was getting my feet wet. And that was a bingo call back then for the most part. So I'll give it up to Jim here.
In the days of the in the 80s and into the early 90s, when the games were 4 hours long, you could tell a few stories because there was always a long period of time where they were cleaning up helmets and gloves and sticks off the ice. And so you'd have time. the game is so fast at this point and happens so quickly. And it's not unusual for there to be, in each game that you do, periods of time where there's 6, 8, 10 minutes without a stoppage in play. And I always say to guys that I work with and producers who say they want more stories and things like that, well, if I launch into a story and the Leafs score a big goal or somebody, you know, scores a big goal or there's a big moment in the game, we lose the story and we lose the moment.
Right.
And you don't want to do that. So, you know, I think you have to judge the game. You have to judge where the game is at, what the just like players, coaches are always saying to players, come on, watch the time and score. And then, and what you do changes depending on how much time is left and whether you're leading or behind. And there's, you know, how many goals are differentiate. You do the same thing in our position. You have to pick your spots, and sometimes you pick them and sometimes you don't. It's like the face-off where you decide to say three more words and the puck's in the back of the net.
We are back. It's McCowan. It's Shannon on the program here. It's a podcast, also airs on Sirius XM channel 167. If you're listening to it, then you know that.
And here to dissect the trade, Matt Devlin and Chuck Swirsky.
Jack Eichel to Vegas. Hey, you know, Alex Tuch is, you know, he's a Syracuse guy, so he's Baldwinville, right outside of Syracuse, so he's headed back that way, Buffalo.
Well, I wonder how happy he is. We just mentioned that Eichel saved about $1.2 million in taxes,
yeah,
going from New York to Nevada. Tuck's going to get dinged. Not at the same total, but the same rate going the other direction.
Yeah. But
closer to home, I guess. Anyway, good to see you two guys. How are you?
But by the way, speaking of taxes, have you noticed grocery prices here in the States, Bob? They're like off the charts. I mean, it's real. I just had to get in my soapbox about that.
I got news for you. Go try and buy a 2x4.
Hey, or fill up your car.
Yeah.
Gas prices.
Everything is just out of sight.
It is.
It's just two simple words, boys. Two simple words. They're going to be the buzzwords of the last 2 months of this year. Supply chain.
Yeah.
Supply chain. That's it.
Yeah.
Well,
so, question. Bob, we have been on the road. We've had 4 road games. And every time we're in a city, you know, you kind of just stop into a drugstore, department store to pick up something.
Yeah.
And the shelves are either barren or semi.
Yeah.
And so, like yesterday in Philadelphia, you know, like the individual behind the counter is saying, well, we have no clue when trucks are showing up. We have no idea what they're going to bring. We've been waiting for goods, and so, like, it's ridiculous. So I'm not sure what's going on in Canada, but in the United States, it's a real issue. So
well, I go. Don't know. I don't know what you went to buy, Swirsk, but I'm guessing it wasn't shampoo.
No.
How am I doing? Not.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Oh. See, that's why they pay you the big bucks.
Yeah, Well, I'm observant, if nothing else.
Yes.
Okay, so I did no homework as usual for this program. I'm with you know, a bunch of pals here, and I generically remember things, but not specifically. Swirsky, when did you leave? When did you abandon Toronto?
Abandon ship. That's, okay.
So what year was there. That?
So that was 2008. We had just finished the playoffs. The Raptors played the Orlando Magic in the playoffs in early May. And we were eliminated in the first round. And I went in to talk to Tom Anselmi, I think the second week in May, and tendered my resignation.
Because you already had another job.
Well, because I had been offered the job.
Right.
I was given a 48-hour window to make a decision. And after discussing things with my family, we felt that in the best interest of my family that it was probably the prudent thing to do.
Okay, so then, Maddie, you're in Charlotte at that point,
yeah.
Is that correct?
Yeah, yeah.
So when would you have heard of, hey, the Raptor job is open? How does that work in the NBA, circles of the NBA?
I was having lunch. I remember it vividly. I was having lunch. I want to say, Chuck, maybe that announcement came on Tuesday. Pardon me. That you were moving on to Chicago. And Wednesday, I was having lunch with Carl Scheer, who's a longtime executive in the NBA as well as ABA. And we had weekly lunches. Mm-hmm. He actually traded for Alex English when he was in Denver as a general manager. And I always cherished those weekly lunches with him, just to soak up all the knowledge that he had about the league. And we sat there. He said, hey, did you hear Chuck was going to Chicago? I said, no, I didn't. He said, I think there might be some interest there. And so that was Wednesday. Thursday, I received a phone call from Brian Colangelo and then also Chris Hebb. On that Friday, Sunday, I flew up to Toronto, met with Jason Capone, who I had known from Charlotte, and we talked about Toronto. And then Mark Askin picked me up on Monday, drove me around Toronto, and then I had a meeting with Tom Anselmi, Chris Hebb, as well as Brian Colangelo and Maurizio Gherardini. And then coming back from there, you know, I spoke to Jack Armstrong, who I've known for a long time. And Jack gave me Chuck's number. I called up Chuck to ask about his experience in Toronto. And obviously it was glowing and had so many great things to say about it. So we kept in touch during that time. And that really kind of began, you know, the process. I was the first one in, they said, to talk to him. They had some other candidates that they wanted to talk to as well. And I want to say it was, everything got wrapped up in July is when everything ultimately got wrapped up. And that was when they were announcing the Jermaine O'Neal trade was kind of the first day that I was on the job.
Well, clearly, you guys will have different memories of the organization, Chuck from a period before and Matt with a, from a period after 2008. But you're not unfamiliar with the eras in which you weren't here. I got a bunch of things that just off the top of my head. It's easy to say that the best team the Raptors ever had was the one that won the championship. Here's the ultimate question, though. Who's the best player to ever play for the Toronto Raptors? And, you know, you have to take a whole bunch of things into consideration when you answer that kind of question. Chuck's nodding, but thinking at the same time. Have you made up your mind on who the best Raptor ever was?
Well, again, you know what? I mean, listen, these players are terrific. And I never like to compare players, Bob. And I know people love to do that, and understandably so, because that's the beauty of sport. I think you have to look at who they're playing with at the time, the era in which they're playing, and against whom they're playing against. I mean, you can make an argument for Lowry. You can make an argument for DeRozan. You can make an argument for Carter. And all three would be in the mix. Obviously, the Raptors won a title with Kyle Lowry and with Kawhi Leonard, although I'm going to put an asterisk with Kawhi because he was basically a rent-a-player player, right. And it worked, you know, and more power to it. I mean, they picked him up for the sole reason of going deep in the playoffs. They won a championship, and Masai did his job. Kawhi did his job, and the city benefits. Mm-hmm. So, you know, at the end of the day, you know, if I had a pecking order, which I don't, but if I did, it would probably be Lowry 1, DeRozan 1A, and then Vince.
Really? You have two guys ahead of Carter.
Well, just because of longevity. And, you know, I mean, listen, Vince put basketball on the map. I saw it. I called every one of his games, And without Vince Carter, I'm not sure where the Raptors franchise would be. Remember, John, you were there and Bob was there, that there were already stories percolating had Vince not signed that max deal with the Raptors where this franchise was going, because we saw Vancouver dissolve in front of our very eyes. And I'm not saying that would have happened in Toronto with a larger financial foundation and a corporate base, but, you know, the way Vince came onto the scene at that stage, Bob and John, remember, Carlos Delgado was the face of the Blue Jays.
That's right.
Really good player, but the Jays were going nowhere. Matt Sundin leaves hockey. They had their moments, but he was a very low-key, no vibe, just give me a hockey stick and let me play type player. No qualms about that. Great. I love Matt Sundin. But Vince had flair. He was in the city, lived in the city. He had it going. He was on the cover of Sports Illustrated as a rookie. He's on ESPN every night. We're selling out the ACC at that time, the ACC, 19,800. And basketball was the in thing to do. So, and then the knee injury happened, and we know the rest of the story with the trade to the Nets.
Matty D, give us your best Raptor ever.
Yeah, no, I think it's Kyle because of obviously what he accomplished here and the championship run. And to echo what Chuck mentioned, Vince Carter, you cannot overlook what he did for basketball in the country. The Carter effect is real. We know that. You talk to any of the NBA players from Canada, from right here in Toronto, and they will point to that. And so that is something that is lasting. And then you're going to have that championship run, and that's going to be lasting as well. And Kyle Lowry, because of the time that he spent here, because of what he was able to accomplish here, to me, he's number one. I think it's unfortunate, and you know, Chuck would have a better sense of this because I, you know, heard, you know, obviously everything. You know, it's unfortunate that things ended the way they ended with Vince at that time. But he was a figure, and at the time I'm living in the U.S., everybody wanted to see Vince, and I can only imagine with social media. Can you only look back and think what Vince would be on a nightly basis in his prime in Toronto? And so, you know, he's certainly a piece and a pivotal piece at that. But for me, Kyle Lowry is number one. And so much of why you say number one, it's because of what you accomplished ultimately on the court. Did you come away with a victory? And did you end up winning? And did you win in the playoffs? And those are all the things that Kyle was able to do through time and a lot of growth, as we know, with Kyle, with the team and the pieces that were coming and going. And then ultimately bringing in Kawhi Leonard for that year. People forget prior to the stoppage of play, the pandemic, and then also the bubble that, you know, the Raptors had the second best record in the NBA. They had 50, you know, that season, they had 53 wins. They were playing really good basketball. Unfortunately, bubble, lose a game 7 to Boston. Who knows what would have happened with that team, even without Kawhi. And Kyle Lowry's a central figure in that.
I think, look, I saw a clip with LeBron James, and somebody asked him, give me in order the three greatest NBA players of all time. I don't know whether you guys have seen this clip. And LeBron says, wow, that's hard. Well, Michael Jordan. Michael Jordan. Oh, man, this is really hard. Michael Jordan. And that was the end of the clip. And essentially, I know it wasn't intentional, but he basically said Michael Jordan's the three best players ever to play in the NBA. And that's the dilemma that you face with that kind of a question. And I must say, I will say this. I have often wondered, and Chuck, you can identify with this probably a little bit more even than Matt, because you were here for it. Had Vince Carter left under different terms, had Vince Carter left under the same terms that Kyle Lowry left, would he be viewed more positively, especially by Toronto Raptor fans? I think Vince Carter was the greatest player to play here. Not the most impactful, but the era in which he played and the players that surrounded him were not of the same caliber as they were when Kyle was here.
I agree.
And remember this, and you'll know this better than I, how many times did Vince Carter lead the voting in All-Star balloting? And that doesn't necessarily mean the fans think he's the best player in the NBA, but it tells you he's in the discussion. And I would say to you guys that Kyle Lowry has, you know, with due respect, was never in that conversation. Yeah. Thoughts on that,
Chuck? You know what, Bob? Listen, that's the beauty of a debate. You know,
sure.
Matt has an opinion. I've got an opinion. You and John have an opinion, and that's why sport is sport, and the essence of how we view optically a player or a team or an era. And you know, we were just in Boston and we had a conversation about the 86 Celtics, arguably one of the greatest teams in the history of the sport.
Is that Dave Cowens?
No, this is post Dave Cowens. This is with Bird and McHale and Parrish and Dennis Johnson. And so, you know, and I'm sitting next to a guy every night, Bill Wennington, a proud Canadian of Montreal, and he was a rotation player, part-time starter, but he was on the 72-10 Bulls team. And right. You could argue that that team is probably the greatest team in the history of the sport. Because remember, Golden State did win 73, but they didn't win the title.
Right.
And so, I mean, that's great thing about sport, you know? But I do agree with you about Vince, because it really, as we all know that we're there, it spiraled out of control in that period of time when, you know, the front office was going through changes, the coaching staffs were changing left and right, and there was no fluidity whatsoever as far as the scene of putting everything together. It became very tattered. And that's when Vince wanted out, then he started to change his mind. But by that time, it was too late, and you know the rest.
I tell you what, Maddie brought up a really key point about, hey, could you imagine all the attention Vince got if there were social media when Vince played? But I'll tell you what, could you imagine all the other stuff that circulated around Vince and his family and Charles Oakley and Butch Carter and everybody within the Raptor, if there was social media like that, because it circulated anyway. it circulated without social media, and the soap opera, you know, part of the great thing about Carter was, and I do think Carter was the best player. I also think he was the most influential because of the legacy that he created, but he's tainted in many ways. He's tainted because of everything around him. Everything that occurred around him, and that's me as an observation of somebody outside the organization and somebody inside the organization. Yeah, and John, I think that's a factor.
John and Bob, don't you think, and Matt, we've come full circle. There's a generation removed, maybe two, from Vince as a Raptor. And I mean, the way, you know, time heals a lot of wounds. They really do. And, you know, the way the city and the organization has now embraced Vince, especially when, you know, the twilight of Vince's career, when he was playing with different teams, and he was coming through Toronto, and you saw the love that Vince received from the fan base. I think if you ask fans now about Vince, they have like a lot of great things to say about him, and understandably and rightfully so. Now, if you ask that question early 2000s after he left for the Nets. And we all remember that Friday game when he returned in a Nets uniform, which was...
It wasn't pretty.
No, it was not. But we're talking 2021 now. Mm-hmm. And he is going into the Hall of Fame. And if you ask most people, what team do you connect Vince Carter with? It's not the Nets. And it's not a host of teams that he played for, whether it's Dallas, Memphis, Phoenix, Sacramento, whomever. It's with the Toronto Raptors.
So there you go. Some of the best of the Bob McCown podcast from the past 12 months as we take a little vacation here, much to the chagrin of the audience, I'm sure.
Well, not much of a vacation when you think of what's going on in the world, Bob. Still, but you know what? It's a good time to spend your family, good time to have some quiet time, enjoy some eggnog and some festive spirit.
Happy holidays to y'all from John and I. And we'll see you in the first week of January. Goodbye, everybody.